Your local radio. Across central southern Dorset.
Keep 106.
Keep 106.
You are listening to Ridgeway Magazine with John Shepherd and Andy Fenton.
Just a little loving early in the morning beats a cup of coffee for starting off the day. Just a little loving when the world is yawning makes you wake up feeling good, things are coming.
Hello, and good of you to join us. We take a literary turn in today's show when we hear from three authors who talk about their new books, Embracing Poetry, Marine Ecology, and a look at the life and times of Charles Dickens.
And variety is the spice of life, and with that in mind, we talk to the Weymouth and Portland Lions, who are putting on a musical show at the Pavilion in the next few days. Our gardening expert, Ruth, has a bunch of ideas, and we celebrate the 70th anniversary of the zebra crossing. All that in 56 minutes as John begins the countdown.
Our first guest is local author Jim Potts. Now, perhaps local is not quite the right word to describe someone who has settled in this county after a life filled with travel and traveller's tales. He's here, live in the studio, not only to tell us a little about his peripatetic life, but also about the books of poems which are to be published this month. Now, it's a very unusual interviewee we have here because he has a file on him by the Czechoslovakian secret police, who showed a great deal of interest in his life at one stage. So, Jim, you better tell us what put you on the spot.
Well, good morning, John and Andy, and thanks for having me at Keep 106. That's a leading question, isn't it? It's true that when I worked in Prague and when it was Czechoslovakia, my job was director of the British Council, but as the communist government didn't recognise British Council, I was also the cultural attaché in the British Embassy.
Can I just stop you there? Better tell people what the British Council is.
Good point. Well, do you want the long version or the short version?
It does vary.
It has a royal charter. It's an organisation which was set up to spread British awareness of British culture overseas. That was in 1934. And it was very, very important in the period just before the war and, of course, after the war. I worked in Ethiopia, where the work was mostly to do with aid, and I was working in educational television and radio, setting up a station to broadcast for teacher training and to teach English. In Kenya, it was films for teacher training. That was a specialist field. I was a television officer in those days. In other countries, English teaching was very important, as in Greece. We had large institutes teaching English. But cultural relations really is the key word in science, education, and the arts broadly. If it's in a developing country, of course, the work was very much more to do with agricultural development and scientific exchanges. So hard to summarise, but it does vary according to the country and their needs.
So it's not necessarily occupied by a bunch of culture vultures. It is more than culture, isn't it?
Oh, much more. I think there was a period when the newspapers used to have a go at the idea of it being cultural and sending sort of Morris dancers to Pakistan, that sort of thing. But no, it's not like that at all. It's much more professional and focused on priority needs of the countries. So,
well, let me not interrupt the story because it is fascinating. Because let's go to your poems. A number of your poems reflect on situations in the country in which you were active at the time. I'm thinking in terms of cultural revolutions and revolution itself.
Well, that's true. I mean, it's not always something I want to remember, but of course I was in Greece for 5 years, well actually for 1 year to start with, in 1967 when the military coup took place under the colonels, and I was back again in the 80s for 5 years. But yeah, I was there in the first year of the military government, the military dictatorship, so I got very interested in Greek culture at that time, and a lot of it was being suppressed because, you know, the music of Mikis Theodorakis, for instance, was banned, and there was a lot going on in London too, concerts later on with musicians and writers and composers, some of them who'd been in prison on prison islands. Then in Ethiopia, I was 5 years in Ethiopia, and the last year I was there, there was the big Ethiopian revolution, which followed one of the great famines that had happened. And that was very nasty revolution, very violent, with red terror and white terror. And well, we had our house stoned at the time, but nothing, we didn't suffer as much as... I was actually playing six-a-side cricket one day when they executed 60 of the government who they were deposing. So it was, you know, you could hear that.
My goodness me. I mean, did you follow trouble or did trouble follow you?
Well, I don't know, because then I was... the Czechoslovakian revolution, fortunately, was called the Velvet Revolution because it was non-violent. So that was when the Berlin Wall fell and a lot of countries throughout Central and Eastern Europe and the Balkans, one after the other, they changed to a more democratic style of government.
So that was about 1989. So tell me about the secret police. I mean, did this worry you?
Well, I'd been... Obviously, we were warned that we needed to be careful. But my job was to make friends with and have good contacts with writers and artists. And a lot of them were considered not only unofficial, but dissident or semi-dissident. They were banned from publishing, many of them. But I worked across the board with the government agencies and with people who, you know, were very glad to have contact with people representing more liberal countries at the time. What can I say?
Were you ever in fear of your life?
No, not at all, no. Although I have to say, a very good friend of mine, needn't mention his name, but in Greece, of all places, was assassinated in Athens, largely because either it was mistaken identity or it was because Britain had arrested some terrorists, and this was a sort of revenge. We were obviously a soft target because we were not protected.
Now, I've been told that in your time in the States, you actually used the same studio as Elvis Presley. So did you have... were you involved in local radio or community radio in any way?
Well, I had been in Australia, in Sydney. It was in the evenings, once a week. I had a three-hour blues music program. I'm rather keen on blues, but I love jazz and rock and roll and classical, it has to be said. I'm not...
Well, actually, you're in very good company here, because Andy and I love jazz, and you probably noticed a little bit of jazz, which I'm able to squeak in as a signature tune for Ridgeway Magazine.
I did, yeah. It was really... I wanted to hear more of it.
Well, I shall make sure you do.
Okay.
Now, let's come on to poetry. I mean, poetry to me is a kind of... is very foreign. I don't know very much about it. And I think I was weaned off poetry when I was at school, when it was sort of pushed at you. You will learn a poem. How did you start writing poetry?
Oh, I must have been about 15 or 16, I suppose. I might have written maybe a few before that at school, but... yeah, I think I had a good friend who's just published a novel who we grew up in the same town in Castlecary in Somerset. And I think we were thinking of going to university and started trying to be writers as well. He became a publisher himself, and he's just, as I say, published a novel called Life's... what's it called, Mark? It's called Life Term. It's Life Term with Colenso Books. And that's the same publisher as I have, fortunately. So we started writing then, and then my first girlfriend inspired me to write a few poems, as one does.
You were writing love sonnets, were you?
Well, I'm not sure I could manage a sonnet at those times. But
do you think it's time for a poem?
You could, yeah, well, you could have one. I mean, I could write one, actually. I wrote... wrote about school. Can I write one?
Oh, please do.
About school. This was in Sparkford in Somerset, and I was, for a few years, I was a pretty good cricketer, but I didn't follow it through. It's called Dig That. You know the phrase, dig that, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I dig that. This one is called Dig That. I was Americanized early. Though I was always last one in to bat, I opened the bowling. As a fielder, I had no peer. I could hurl the ball from the boundary line and hit the wicket with such a deadly aim that the stumps would go flying. They'd be run out. We'd shout, "How's that?" in deepest rural Somerset. When I was only 12, I'd won my colours, my first 11 cap, but I offended the head. He hauled me over the mat when I hollered in triumph, "Dig that! Dig that!" It wasn't cricket, so he used the bat. Dig that, the first rebellion of a real cool cat.
Oh, I like that. Very good.
That's more
good.
One of the funnier ones. But
So there you were at school playing cricket. Did you play cricket in later life? I mean, journeys?
I think the last time I was playing, I think I mentioned, I was playing six-a-side cricket in Ethiopia when they executed half the government. So that perhaps put me off for some time.
But you were in Australia. Did you play cricket in Australia?
No, I really followed it then. We had some huge programmes. I was travelling all over the country setting up a programme called New Images, which was trying to modernise the whole relationship between Britain and Australia at the time.
Now, not being a poet myself, how do you approach writing a poem? I'm a writer, but not of poetry.
Well, I studied English literature at Oxford, and I suppose I read quite a lot. But usually they just come to you, really. It's not something one sits down. I'm not somebody who sits down and says, "I want to write a poem." It's quite often almost like a reaction to an event, or it could be a way of writing a diary, in a sense. You know, you suddenly get the right phrase to describe something you've witnessed or experienced. There are different types of poems, of course. But
does the phrase come first, then?
With me, I think three or four words might start it off. I mean, when I was very young, I used to wake up in the middle of the night with a bit of inspiration, but that doesn't come so often when you're in your 70s.
And you're still writing, and you told me you've written two books, which are going to be published at the end of the month.
Well, this one has just come out today, actually, called Words on the Table, and the other one before that was called Reading the Signs, and also a book of short stories, which was last year.
Well, give us a flavour of the contents of Words on the Table, was it
Words
called?
On the Table.
Words on the Table.
I call it Words on the Table, and it's got cards on the table, because in a sense it's about laying my cards on the table. I wanted that association in the... what would you like me to say about it? It's got over 200 poems, and it's really written in all of the countries I've ever worked in. And
well, I think I've got to ask you to read something that you're really happy with, something that gives you...
Oh, gosh, well... Well, I'll read you a fairly topical one, if you like, because this was, you know, Firework Night was just recently, and I missed it, unfortunately. I couldn't get to Weymouth or to the rugby club. Don't know if you did. Did you see any?
No, but I heard them.
Oh, you heard them. And, of course, after writing this, I thought, well, it's all very well me being full of praise for firework displays, but I do think of the pets and the dogs and what they suffer as well. So I don't mention that in this poem. This is called Pyrotechnics, November the 5th. Economists frown on firework displays in countries that can't afford them. The social benefits are few. They can't be quantified. To hell with the expense. Why put a price on pleasure? Don't miss the rockets and Roman candles, the whirligigs and Catherine wheels, the showers of silver and golden rain, the shooting stars of green and red, the balls of fire, the twinkling diamonds dropping down, dissolving. In a flash, our flight is over. These days, there's not much mirth. So stand well clear. Don't count the cost. Unite tonight. Light up the sky. That was one about fireworks.
I loved it. I thought it was very, very good. In fact, I think we're going to keep that on and use that perhaps in a year's time. Jim, it's been lovely talking to you. So what have you got planned for the future? Are you still writing?
Well, this book actually collects six decades of poems that I've written, and also the short stories, in a sense, covers my... So in a sense, it's my life's work as far as writing is concerned. I don't think I've got it in me like my friend Mark Allen to write a novel. I mean, he was determined to show he could do it. I haven't. I think short stories are what I wrote one for the Dorset Echo not long ago about Church Ope Cove and the Vikings and their first... landing there. Actually, that was before Lindisfarne. So things that strike me might suddenly become a short story or an article, and I've written about several articles for the Dorset Echo. So I quite like being a community writer, and I'm not sure how soon it will be before I put out another book.
You've given us a flavour of your poetry. So tell us about the books. When are they published, and how do we get them?
Well, literally, I got this book only arrived yesterday, so I've got about 40 copies of it. So I'm starting to send them to friends who are mentioned, or but it's Colenso Books, Colenso, is a small publisher, but a very good one, and the editor, Anthony Hurst, is absolutely brilliant. He's got a special offer for two of my books of poetry, this one and Reading the Signs. For this one, the recommended retail price is £10.75, but if people order it before the end of November, the special offer price is £7.50. And that can be ordered through colensobooks@gmail.com. So colensobooks@gmail.com. If you're interested in both books of poetry, then there's a special offer price of £13. Of course, the postage is extra in the package, but the main thing to remember is just write a note, say where you heard about it on the radio here on Keep 106, and write to colensobooks@gmail.com. But the books will be available at their normal price in, you know, Waterstones and Smith's and other shops, but probably because it's a small publisher that you need to order them there. They're certainly possible to order them at all the bookshops.
Well, Jim, thank you very much indeed for giving us a flavour of your writing, of your poems, and thank you so much for coming in and joining Ridgeway Magazine today.
Thank you very much, John and Andy, for having me again.
Ridgeway Magazine, on Wednesdays at 11, tackles local issues with local views from local people, with John Shepherd and Andy Venton.
Now then, there must be thousands of poems and even more offerings of flowery prose about gardens. But with her feet planted firmly in the reality of the soggy Dorchester soil is our gardening expert, Ruth Hayes, from Amateur Gardening Magazine, with today's topic. Ruth, good morning.
Good morning. And it is a bit soggy out there, isn't it?
I don't think I'll
be working in the garden today. So, but I did think we could talk about, as we're going into autumn and winter and... you know, things in the garden look like they're quietening down. We've possibly taken out our summer bedding and cut back our perennials. It's time to think about our soil, because if we don't look after our soil, we don't get decent plants, and nothing will grow. And like anything, at this time of year, your soil's feeling a bit exhausted, a bit depleted. It's had a busy year of growing stuff. So we need to look after it and feed it.
So the answer lies in the soil.
The answer absolutely does lie in the soil. So really, I mean, that's what I've been doing over the past few days, is sort of preparing the soil for sort of feeding it and looking after it this winter. So I've been weeding. There's always weeding to do. And I use a hoe for this. I hoe probably, well, once a week, I would say, because this cuts off the little weeds at soil level. And you can just leave them lying on the soil and they will die down and actually feed the soil themselves. And like the big perennial weeds, your dandelions and your chickweed and stuff, I always get up by hand. What I don't do at this time of year, in fact, I hardly ever do, I must admit, but don't use weed killer now, because your weeds aren't growing as well. And for most weed killers to work well, they need a good growing season, so the plants will take them in and it kills them from inside.
I see. So it's interesting you say leave the weeds on top of the soil.
Just the little ones, the little sort of baby, I call them weedlings instead of seedlings, because they rot down. And it's like any green material, it's a way of composting, really.
So plucking them out between thumb and forefinger and sort of putting them in your sort of weed basket or whatever it is, it's not necessary.
You can do, it depends what size they are. If they are quite large and visible, I would get them out and chuck them on the compost heap. If they have seed heads on them, I'd just lie them on a path or something for a few days till they completely die back, and then I'd compost them. The very tiny ones you can just hoe over and leave on the soil.
Right. So let's get back to the soil itself. Mm. I mean, it's been very, very poor weather recently.
Oh, it's been shocking.
I see that your Wellingtons are not too muddy.
But, that's because I drove.
I'm sorry, this is radio. I didn't want to mention that, you know, but just in case. But so it's been very, very wet. What effect does that have?
Oh, on the soil?
Hmm.
It can really saturate it. If it has been very wet, if possible, avoid working your soil at all, because you can damage the structure, which is when you compress it, you knock out any air pockets, because it needs to be light and airy so that worms can go through it, so the microbes can, sort of beneficial microbes can feed the soil. And if you sort of trample all over it, it just squashes it down and doesn't do it any good at all.
So can you, well, I don't know whether there is such a phrase in gardening, overdig? In other words, dig your soil too much and too often?
Well, I mean, there is a school of gardening called no-dig gardening, which...
Oh, I like that.
I know. And it is meant to be much better for your soil, because when you dig, you bring weed seeds up to the surface, you can disturb pests so they thrive. But if you don't dig, if you just weed gently and then just add a layer of mulch, of compost or manure on your soil, that will break down over winter and feed your soil. And it gives the weeds less of a chance to germinate. And it's a more natural way of looking after your soil, curating your soil.
So, I mean, which camp do you...
I do a bit of both, actually. I've got some raised beds, which are no dig. We just hoe over the weeds and layer them up with compost, because it does go down over the course of a year or over the course of a season. In the beds, well, to be fair, actually mainly no dig in the beds as well. Occasionally turn it over if it's got very compact, if it's had an intensive patch of growing and the plants have sort of, you know, it sort of settles quite heavily, but then I'll sort of fork it over. But then I'll just throw in over some mulch or some chicken manure pellets, they're good, and just feed it and leave it, and then just gently hoe over the top.
Yeah, chicken manure is very smelly, but it does work, doesn't it?
It works very well, and you can buy the pellets. They're available at any garden centre, and they don't smell. But do dig them in, as with bloodfish and bone, because otherwise you will attract foxes and badgers and they'll dig it up and try and eat it.
Oh, good advice. Had a question from a listener.
Mm.
I don't know whether it's a silly question or not, but I'll have a go. She says that she has been putting grass cuttings in the same pile for the last 15 years. So she's got 15 years of grass cuttings in a pile. I take it that it's not a huge lawn. But... her question was, are these grass cuttings any use? Because obviously, you know, the ones that are 15 years old or 10 years old or 5 years old would have sort of mulched down, if that's the phrase.
Yeah, good Lord, that's quite a tricky question. I mean, you can use grass clippings as a mulch. I sometimes use them in summer on around my vegetables just to keep the soil damp and to... you know, they will release some goodness. If it's been there 15 years, I suspect the ones at the bottom will probably have rotted down quite nicely. But what I would probably say is they'll have generated quite a lot of warmth in there, and you're going to have things possibly hibernating in there. You might have a few toads, some slow worms, hedgehogs. So I would probably leave it until spring.
Right. Now, if she has a compost heap, could she, you put some of the older grass cuttings into the mulch that she's...
Yeah, definitely. If it's a general compost heap, yes. Grass is a brilliant ingredient for compost. But what I would say is don't add too much and mix it in well. Otherwise, it can sort of get a bit slimy and smelly and not very nice. So give it a good fork it in with all your other compost ingredients.
Well, with the compost, we are encouraged, are we not, to fork it over from
yes,
time to
you
time.
Should, yeah. And at this time of year, I would also, if we've got a very cold, very dry spell coming up, I would chuck an old bit of carpet on top of your compost to keep in the heat, keep in the moisture. And then when things warm up and rain is forecast, just take it off again.
What about soot from wood-burning stoves?
Soot from wood burning stones, if it's good seasoned wood...
Well, it has to be these days.
It has to be, absolutely. The ashes can be used because they're rich in potassium, so they're good for fruiting, for flowering. But in wet weather, all the goodness washes away really quickly. So what I tend to do is make sure the ashes are completely cold and I store them in a bin liner through the winter in the garage or the shed. And then next spring, sort of early spring, I'll fork them in around my fruit bushes.
Right. Although we were talking about compost heaps because not everybody has fruit bushes.
This is true. You can, again, you can add them to the compost heap, but again, and they will add enrich it with potassium. But again, I would probably wait till spring when it's drier or do it when we've got a dry spell coming up.
Well, Ruth, as always, terrific advice. And thank you very much indeed
for
coming in to see us.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, John. Thanks, Andy.
Keep 106, your local radio.
From gardening, we take a trip to the seaside to meet author and broadcaster Adam Nicholson, who talks about his book, The Sea Is Not Made of Water, Life Between the Tides. Nothing in the sea and in rock pools is quite like it seems.
I must say, your book has got one of the most enticing covers I think I've ever seen.
It's very beautifully done. It has a picture of a prawn, a common prawn, done by a great friend of mine, Kate Boxer. And the whole idea of the book is to take creatures of the seaside that you wouldn't normally pay any attention to, and or very little attention to, and heroise them, in effect. You know, make these tiny little puzzles almost. You know, they're little kind of complexities which can be easily ignored or put in a sandwich, and turn them into the intriguing things I think they are. And that's what Kate has done. On the cover, and in fact all through the book, there's a marvellous one of a green crab looking like Hercules in a rage, and wonderful one of a...
Now we mustn't get away from the fact that we are the Jurassic Coast. Now tell us about the history. What sort of history can we find in our rock pools?
Well, of course, the shore is and always was one of the places where the past was very richly and deeply revealed. Quarries, the shore, railway cuttings are really the source of geological knowledge. And so, as everyone here knows, you go down to the shore and you find the evidence of previous forms of life. And previous forms of life, until, of course, Darwin, were considered just weird things or something that witches made or fairies had made. But the 19th century realised that there had been this fantastic depth of change, that really the meaning of life is as much extinction as persistence, that many, 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 many more species have died than are alive now. And I think that throws a very interesting light on our attitude to life now. You know, there's a great anxiety about the degree of extinction, the sixth mass extinction that's going on at the moment. But extinction, this is what the shore shows you. The shore shows you that extinction is almost necessary. You know, that the competition that brings about extinction is the thing that generates the vivacity of life. Life would not be as lively without the dead. Is the great paradox of it. I mean, that's one of the things one could draw from it.
That's certainly something I would never, ever have thought about, actually, because the whole world is full of complaints, moans, shall we say, danger signals about life which is disappearing, natural life which is disappearing. But you're saying, well, don't worry, this is all about...
No, I'm not saying don't worry. And in fact, the idea that we, this species, us, this human species, could actually generate an extinction which previously had only been generated by asteroid collisions or, you know, mass poisonings of the atmosphere, which is what the previous five have all been about. The very fact that we are doing it, and so rapidly, much more rapidly than previous extinctions, is itself a catastrophe. I mean, people often think, you often read... You know, pay attention to nature because without nature, our lives would not survive. And that is probably true about this extinction, that if we do end up killing everything, then human beings won't survive. But there are, you can take a step beyond that and say, yes, okay, human beings won't survive. Life will undoubtedly survive, because life has undoubtedly survived previous 95%, 98% removal of pre-existing species. Life is, the core of life is resilience in the face of extinction. And I rather think it's too anthropocentric to think, you know, if we die, then that is the kind of terminal catastrophe. I don't think it is.
So you said that our rock pools are full of life. What gave you the idea for the title of the book, The Sea Is Not Made of Water?
Yes, well, all the 8 and 9 year old children of my friends, they say, have only one answer to that. the idea of the title is that I was dragging a bay in the west coast of Scotland for plankton a couple of summers ago, and put the water, what looked like water you collect in a little phial at the bottom of the plankton net, put it into the a dish in my microscope. And what I had thought was water, what, you know, to ordinary everyday human sight was water, was in fact a myriad of different life forms all scuttling around beneath me. And so it was only a question of scale which had allowed me to think that the sea was made of water. The sea isn't made of water, the sea is made of life. And really that's what this book is about, that all you've got to do is to go slow, go small, go attentive, and you start to see this dazzling strangeness in front of you, which is, of course, there all the time. I mean, you could do it in this room. You know, you could look at the surface of that table. It would be absolutely pullulating with life. COVID, bacteria, or virus among it. You know? And so there is a sort of incredible, clumsy indifference, I think, in most of us to the all-presence of life. And that's what that title is meant to mean.
But you see, not everybody is going to be sort of gazing into the sea with a microscope. So what can we see for ourselves? We're very lucky where we live, because we have a richness of sea life. We've got seahorses, for instance.
I know you do. I know. Lucky you. And they're not properly looked after. I know, the seahorses. What do most of us find? Well, if you investigate, for example, the life of the common sea anemone, the beadlet, the red sea anemone, and called an anemone because when the people first started to look at these things in the 18th century, they thought they were flowers. But of course they're not flowers, they're animals. And the other extraordinary thing is if you can unpeel a sea anemone from the rock without any harm, just very, very gently, it's like taking off a plaster. If you take an anemone from one pool high up the shore and another pool low down the shore, and put them next to each other in an aquarium, which I've done, they fight each other. These things which have no ears, no eyes, no brain, no central nervous system, no gut, even no skin, are nevertheless able to recognise that their enemy has come to live next door to them.
What a fascinating fact. Your book is published by William Collins at price £20, and of course you can buy it from Waterstones in Dorchester. Thank you very much indeed for talking to Ridgeway Magazine.
And now it's showtime with news which comes from those irrepressible lions, the Weymouth and Portland Lions Club, who promise an evening of local talent with their latest variety show in aid of local charities. The man responsible is Lion Norman Stagels, who tells us the Lions have been producing shows big and small for many years.
For one night only, the Lions Variety Show returns to Weymouth Pavilion. And what a show it's going to be. The organiser is Norman Stagels, and he is going to be telling us what's in the show this year. Quite a variety of acts. Who's going to be starting the show?
Well, we're going to open the show, John, with Julie Storer's Let's Dance Club. So it's a nice professional-looking opening. That's going to be followed by the world-renowned Tamara Constantine, who's a concert pianist with her violin accompanist. We then have the White Ukadelics, and they're going to be playing a number of songs which I'm sure people will want to sing along to.
So the Ukadelics, who are they?
They're just a ukulele group where they've got a bass ukulele and lead ukuleles and all sorts of things. But very entertaining.
How many of them are there on stage?
I think there's 12 this year.
Really? Oh, that's quite something.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, what about singers?
Singers, yeah, we've got, in the second act, we have the Decadets.
Ah, yes, they're very...
quite well known in the area.
Indeed they are, yes.
And that's followed by music from Weymouth Band Replay, and with Annie Mac and Norman doing a duo sing-along. And also, this year, we're very pleased to have the internationally renowned Ben Waters, who's a boogie-woogie piano player, joining us on stage.
Now, he's played with Jules Holland. He's...
yes.
Hasn't he? He's written quite a bit, I guess.
Yes, that's right.
And who else have you got?
Well, that about wraps it up. We'll be wrapping up the evening with everybody on stage singing along, and hopefully getting the audience to sing along as well. Weymouth Band Replay are renowned for bringing the audience in because of the music they play, which is late 50s, early 60s music. So a lot of the people of, shall we say, the senior generation these days will enjoy the music that they're going to play.
Now, you were telling me earlier that, in fact, the show started off life many years ago as a sort of visiting Christmas carol operation.
Yes, it did, yes, but it, as time went on, and people's likes and dislikes changed, it's morphed into a variety show. And because we can't have the show in December because of pantomimes and so on, we have it as close to as possible, but we try not to do the Christmas thing because there's a heck of a lot of other Christmas music being played in shops and everywhere, so we tried to make it look a bit different.
Well, it sounds like you've succeeded, because you've been going for quite some years now. It's at the Pavilion Theatre. Good. And I think they've got about, almost 1,000 seats. So how much are the tickets?
Tickets are only £5, and they're available from the box office or online box office.
All right. So let's do remind us, please, of the date.
It's the 30th of November.
And the time?
The show will start at 7:30.
And it's pretty good value for money, because I sort of think to myself, what else can you do for a fiver for an evening's entertainment? And what time does the show start? Finish?
Oh, well, it depends really how well it goes with regards to the audience joining in, but it'll be about 10:30.
Well, I hope you get plenty of encores, and I wish you all the very best for your show, and delighted that it has returned again after the pause for last year, when, of course, you couldn't do it because of COVID restrictions. So thank you.
That's very kind of you.
So thank you for talking to Ridgeway Magazine.
Now, we promised you that we would have more literary content in this programme, and our next contributor is A.N. Wilson, who talks about his book entitled The Mystery of Charles Dickens. Dickens knew of what he wrote. He had a miserable childhood, and he witnessed poverty and pain his characters endured in Victorian England. A fascinating talk, because of two things I could be sure of when I was at school, probably much the same time as you, was Shakespeare and Dickens. And of course I preferred Dickens. But I had no idea of the complexity of his own life. And you talked about peeling back the layers of Dickens. So could you do that for me now?
Well, I think that any great artist they're not necessarily writing autobiography as such, but they are drawing on their own experience, which is something different. Dickens, as I tried to say in my talk, was really the only great 19th century writer in English who'd experienced the full horror of life in Victorian England. Most of them, even the Bronte sisters who were poor and sick, were cushioned from the full horror story of what it was like living in a Victorian city, which was very frightening apart from anything else. It was violent. There was more or less ungoverned crime in most parts of London and Birmingham and Manchester and Sheffield and places of that kind. Children were sent to work. The poverty was, by modern standards, unimaginable. And, as you know, as all your listeners know, you to be sent to prison for debt. And this is what happened to Dickens's parents. Meanwhile, he was being sent as a child labourer to Warren's Blacking, number 30, the Strand, which he found humiliating beyond expression. So it was an experience which he hid. Nobody knew that he'd done that until after he died, and it came out in his biography.
He's a very complex character. I mean, I'm familiar from childhood, I've seen pictures of Dickens in the fly leaves of all the books. But you look at his face, can you read him?
No is the simple answer to that. I've written a book called The Mystery of Charles Dickens, because he concealed his secrets in the best possible way, namely in open air, in plain air. The story of his childhood humiliations, the story of his parents' bankruptcy and going to Marshalsea prison for debt, instead of hiding them completely, he hid them as fictions. And similarly, all the pains and horrors of his family life, which was loveless from his point of view, he hid and made this whole series of monster females throughout his fiction. I'm sure if you'd said to Charles Dickens, if he was sitting with us now, you obviously hated your mother, he would say, of course I didn't. But it's clear that he did. It's clear that this was the central psychological fact about Dickens, that he grew up hating the person who wouldn't return his love or who wouldn't give him love as a child.
There's a lot of sorrow and hatred in his writing. Yes, let's put aside just for a moment, you know, the books which are full of comedy. But, I mean, when I was a child, I was literally frightened when I read the full David Copperfield, not the abridged version, but the full version, and the horror of Murdstone, the horror of Squeers.
Well, I think everybody's horrified by what happens when foolish Mrs. Copperfield, silly little doll, as it were, marries Mr. Murdstone, who immediately starts persecuting her beloved son, David. That's one of the most powerful things in literature, isn't it? May I pick up something you said, though, that about Dickens, the tragic side of Dickens and the terribly sad things such as Mr. Murdstone, and on the other side, the comedy, because I think one of the things I found most liberating about discovering Dickens when I was a child was that he makes even the most terrifying figures and the most violent figures ridiculous as well as frightening, so that he's able to see that life's horrors are comic as well as horrifying. Laughter is the great sort of salvation for Dickens, I think.
But could you put that into the 20th century, where there have been horrors, and I think of dictators?
Well, I mean, the answer to that is probably no, really. I mean, one couldn't make a comedy about the death camps or the Gulag Archipelago. But it is noticeable when you're actually in the midst of horror, then the Dickensian experience is demonstrated. For instance, during the Second World War, lots of people in pubs and camps and in army barracks and so on, rather than just being frightened of Hitler, imitated him, goose-stepped, pretended to have a moustache and all that sort of thing. And of course that doesn't make what Hitler did comic in any possible way, but it's an example of how programmes like ITMAR on what was the Home Service in those days, it is rather Dickensian actually, the jokes such as the good thing about the Blitz is it takes your mind off the war and all those sort of silly jokes that they made.
Coming back to Dickens, he actually wasn't very nice to his family, was he? Why was that? He comes across as a very mixed up character.
He behaved appallingly to his wife. His wife was a prop and stay to him. She bore him 9 children. There was no harm in her whatsoever. And he turned against her. And it's one thing for a man to fall in love with somebody else. That happens all the time. But the vile way in which he treated her, the cruelty with which he put her away, and the near violence with which he warned his children against having anything more to do with her, that is hard to understand. There were two sides to Dickens. That there was the philanthropist, who was a wonderful social reformer, who prison visitor, somebody who taught in ragged schools, and so forth, and also rescued women. He and Angela Burdett Coutts, the greatest philanthropist of the age, started this thing called Urania Cottage in Shepherd's Bush, which was rescuing women who'd fallen foul of the system and then giving them better lives and enabling them to go to Australia or Canada. So, I mean, on the one hand, he was a great philanthropist. On the other hand, he was a monster. And even while being a prison visitor, for example, he called for fiercer and more horrible treatment of the prisoners. He didn't really want the reform of criminals. He wanted them to go on being monsters.
Now, I suppose today you'd say that Dickens was a star, because in his time he had an enormous, what we call, fan club, and it was international.
There's never been a writer, certainly hadn't been in his day, who was as famous as Charles Dickens, partly because of the railways and his novels were distributed so quickly, because they all came out in serial form. You could buy them as like buying a cheap little magazine on the station platform, partly through the medium of faster steamships and things taking his books around the world. He was famous all over the world from the moment that the Pickwick Papers was published in 1837. Dickens' mania overtook Russia, Poland, France, Germany, and of course the United States, where he was so popular that they were waiting on the docks for the next episode of The Old Curiosity Shop. Crowds shouting out, "Is she dead? Is she dead?" for little Nell. Had she died, or was he going to rescue her? Then, after that period, came the great period of Dickens going round performing. I think performing is better than reading as a verb, because he didn't really read, he knew them all by heart anyway. He would enact the murder of Nancy, he would enact the Christmas Carol, and thousands upon thousands of people in all the cities of the United Kingdom and then all over the United States, dozens of cities visited, thousands of people came to hear him do these performances, many of them illiterate. He always made provision for free seats to be put into the auditorium, so that although some people paid to hear him, that there were always hundreds of seats which were free seats, so people who were not so well off to come and hear him.
So if Dickens was alive today, would he be a multi-millionaire? Would there be merchandising? Would there be Dickens T-shirts? Did he make a lot of money?
He made a great deal of money. And certainly nowadays, if he had a proper agent and so on, which he didn't, he'd be making even more money. And yes, you're right to say, of course, even in his own day, there was merchandise, but in those days, he didn't. The profits from Mr. Pickwick Toby Jugs or something of that kind didn't come his way, whereas now there would be Oliver Twist T-shirts and all the rest of it.
I got to ask you the desert island question now. What was your, or is your, favourite Dickens, I'm not going to say book, Dickens work, because there were essays and as well?
Yes, there were, and it's a very hard one, and I always think when I finished a Dickens novel, that's the best. I love that one the best. I think if you had to say you're going to be put in a cell or on a desert island with only one, it would be Little Dorrit.
Hey, Ian Wilson, delighted to talk to you, and thank you very much for giving me your time today. A.N. Wilson's book entitled The Mystery of Charles Dickens is published by Atlantic Books, price £9.99. Actor Martin Clunes is in danger of becoming a national treasure. I'm sure he's far too young, but nevertheless, he does an enormous amount of work for charity, and what he does is treasured very much by the charities he support. Andy, you've got the latest on this, haven't you?
I have indeed, yes. Of course, Martin Clunes is a very busy actor, and he has been at it again. That is, using bright ideas to aid local charities. In support of the Weldmar Hospice and the services it provides, he offered for auction on eBay a walk-on part for a couple and one for an individual to appear in the last ever episode of his long-running series Doc Martin. The show goes down well in the United States because a couple from Michigan paid £4,600 for the privilege of meeting the actors, visiting the set and its makeup, hairdressing department and the costume trailer where they would have been kitted out for their moment of fame. The individual bidder gave £2,450 for the same opportunity to join the cast for a day. And another brainwave from animal-loving Martin, which went down well with the users of Weldmar's day services, was the visit by the actor accompanied by his heavy horse, Bruce, who, everyone was told, enjoys a day out. For those unable to go outside into the gardens, Martin went into the hospice and visited patients with his dog called Bob Jackson. And children's hospice charity Julia's House also benefited from a bright idea. Martin Clunes had tried his hand at growing sunflowers on his farm near Bemminster. These he cut and sold through local shops and raised £2,000 for the charity.
He followed this up by saying that he didn't think he'd been terribly successful at growing sunflowers. He said he could do better and perhaps he'll try again next year. What a champion. Now, listeners to Ridgway Magazine in the past will know that Andy very often has something called Andy's Funny Bone, where he chooses something amusing which he wants to share with listeners. So I'm going to give him the opportunity a moment. And we're reading from a book called Dorset Wit and Humour, which you can buy from Palmbury Garden Centres, price £3.99, and it is an anthology of local stories.
And here's one of those stories now. A passenger in a taxi tapped the driver on the shoulder to ask him something. The driver screamed, lost control of the cab, nearly hit a bus, drove up over the curb and stopped just inches from a large plate glass window. For a few moments, everything was silent in the cab. Then the driver said, "Please don't ever do that again. You scared the daylights out of me." The passenger, who was also frightened, apologised and said he didn't realise that a tap on the shoulder could frighten him so much, to which the driver replied, "Oh, well, I'm sorry, it's really not your fault at all. Today is my first day driving a cab. I've been driving a hearse for the last 25 years.
Oh, that's a good one.
Very good one. Now, John, are you going to choose one to read as well?
I'd like to cap that story, Andy, if I may, with another reading from this little book, Dorset Wit and Humour. A farmer from Somerset once visited a farmer based near Broad Windsor. The visitor asked, "How big is your farm?" To which the Dorset farmer replied, "Can you see those trees over there? That's the boundary of my farmland." "Is that all?" said the Somerset farmer. "It takes me 3 days to drive to the boundary of my farm." The Broad Windsor man looked at him and said, "I had a car like that once."
Now then, finally today, do you know the zebra crossing is 70 years old? It's one of those life-saving things we all take for granted. Crossing the road safely in England has quite a history, proving the point that bright ideas can be developed and improved over time. In the 1930s and the mid-40s, road traffic was increasing, and so were the fatalities and serious injuries among pedestrians of all ages. Although the volume of traffic was nothing like it is today, a high proportion of casualties were put down to the fact pedestrians were unused to traffic and stepped off the curb without thinking and looking. Something had to be done. To help pedestrians, it was decided to mark a suitable road crossing point with shiny metal studs set into the road's surface. It seemed like a bright idea at the time, but it had a fatal flaw. Although the pedestrians could see the studs, drivers couldn't see them easily. In bad light or poor road conditions, drivers didn't recognise the studs in time to stop. Pedestrians and drivers were helped further by the Belisha Beacon, the bright yellow globe atop a black and white pole positioned on either side of the crossing point. But in the old days, they didn't flash. After the war, as car ownership increased, a better, safer crossing was needed, and among the methods investigated was painting the road with black and white stripes. Seems obvious now. The first, newly named Zebra Crossing, was opened with a walkover in Slough 70 years ago, almost to the day in 1971. However, here was some controversy about the highly visible markings. Motorcyclists complained the white stripes were dangerous as the surface was slippery when wet, more so than the black stripes.
Making the crossing the road safer has exercised the minds of road engineers for years. The zebra has spawned many other types of crossing with animal themes. There's been the pelican crossing. The next improvement was called the puffin crossing, which was shortened. There was a shortened name for pedestrian user-friendly intelligent crossing, the puffin. Then there is the toucan crossing for cyclists and the pegasus crossing for horse riders. By far the most famous zebra crossing is the one that entered pop culture and features the Beatles crossing Abbey Road in London on the album cover of the same name. The traffic stopped for them because, had it not done so, the penalty for a motorist failing to give way to pedestrians on a crossing is £100 and 3 penalty points. And motorists must stop for lollipop men or ladies, even if there is no zebra crossing. But for all the investment in crossing safely, 5,500 pedestrians are either killed or seriously injured on our roads each year, according to the Department of Transport. Quite a sobering thought.
Absolutely. And on that thought, we bring to an end this edition of Ridgeway Magazine. John, give us a little taster of what might be in the next programme, very quickly.
Oh, I wish you hadn't asked me that. It's one of those evolving things, actually. But I'm sure we will be talking to Ruth, and we're going to be talking, I hope, to the cost of going green.
Oh, I say, that sounds very interesting. Sorry, I put you on the spot there a little
Indeed
bit.
Indeed you did. But it just goes to show that this programme evolves.
Absolutely. And that's it, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for listening. Do look after yourselves. And until we meet again, from John Shepherd and me, Andy Benton, cheerio for now.